You are listening to Eon. AEON.net.au.
You are listening to the TER podcast, the Teachers Education Review.
Hello everyone, and welcome to the Teachers Education Review, the Australian podcast for teachers that bridges the gap between research, policy, and practice. This is episode number 151, released on Sunday the 7th of June, 2020. I'm Cameron Malcher. In this episode, I look at how teachers can go about addressing divisive and controversial issues in society through their classroom conduct. And for our main feature, Stephen Kolber presents a special edition of Kolber's Corner, in which he interviews Chris Munro about the value of professional coaching for teachers. This episode is going online on the 7th of June, though truly it feels like years have passed since the 1st of January. Australia has seen a horrific season of bushfires. There has been a global pandemic that has caused widespread economic collapse and cost hundreds of thousands of lives. And now, arising out of the United States, the world is engaged in a global moment of protest against systemic inequalities that have seen people of particular racial minorities in developed countries mistreated, abused, even murdered with seeming impunity by those in power. And so as teachers, it should be expected that we might find ourselves engaged in conversations by young people who are still trying to understand and make sense of what they see happening in the world around them. The world that's presented to them through various media sources can result in a very different understanding of the nature and the consequences of what they see happening. And the teacher in the classroom is often one of those few fixed points, one of those trustworthy adults who is supposed to be there to help answer the questions they might have, though not all students might know how to productively raise such questions. But for us teachers, it can sometimes create challenging circumstances. We are expected to maintain a neutrality and apolitical stance on these matters, which, while that in itself may not be a problem, it does remind us that we need to divorce ourselves from what may be strongly held personal opinions when addressing these matters in a school context. But what do you do? How do you go about it when a student, particularly a student who might be of one of the ethnic backgrounds who are subject to the kind of abuse and mistreatment and generational disadvantage that is at the heart of the current global protest movement, when they come up to you and ask a question, when the topic gets raised in the classroom, how do you go about addressing it? Now, some teachers might choose the approach of saying, that's not what this class is about. You know, particularly in high school, it's easy to deflect by saying, we're here to talk about science or maths or this particular aspect of English. Or even in primary school, to deflect and say, that's not the purpose of this class. That's not what we're here to talk about. But any meaningful conception of an effective education is going to talk about developing the whole child, the values and the social engagement of the child. And so to not give students who are curious, who wish to discuss these matters, an avenue for a safe, apolitical, but not necessarily entirely neutral discussion of these matters, a place to do so seems to be neglecting that key aspect of what we do. Now, this podcast, I'm aware, goes out to an international audience, and every education system, every governing body is going to have a different set of expectations for teachers as to how such conversations might be handled in the classroom. And while I do intend to discuss ways of approaching these kind of topics in the classroom, every teacher needs to be aware of what the policies relating to discussing these kind of issues are for their system, for their school, even for potentially their individual faculty. You know, school governance is a widely varied thing, and the last thing you want to do is assume the experiences and expectations that you've heard about discussed in another context apply to you. That is a surefire way to get yourself into a situation you don't want to be in. But the thing that I want to talk about that underpins all of this, and the thing that I think you will find referred to in just about the preface to every syllabus, every policy document that relates to education, is the notion of values and how we do and don't address the concept of values in schools. Because the conversations that are likely to come up, the questions that are likely to be asked, are often going to be the ones centered around values. Why is this happening? Why did that event happen? Why do these people feel that way? And this is something I've had a fair bit of experience in. It was one of the earliest large-scale curriculum initiatives I got involved in early in my career, when the federal government rolled out a national framework for values education in Australian schools. And it's incredible how much work went into an initiative that unfortunately was not rolled out with the consistency and with the public attention that perhaps it warranted. And it certainly wasn't the first time such a thing had been attempted, but it was another attempt. But it was the attempt at that time. I think it was first published in about 2005. And it's quite incredible to read. And I still today go back and read over some of those documents, sometimes with a sense of incredulity at what it is that governments have put forward as the underlying values of an education system that clearly don't align with some of the behaviours and expectations that are placed upon education systems. Because the issue of values is what is at the core of topics that make things controversial. Now, politics are obviously a bigger part of what makes things controversial, but that's often party politics. And as much as I have outspoken political beliefs myself, you would never be advocating a partisan political belief in a classroom. That's recruiting, that's propaganda. I wouldn't want somebody with beliefs other to my own to be doing that to young impressionable minds. And for the same reason, I wouldn't be doing that to the students in my classroom. But when we talk about values, when we talk about the goals underpinning our Australian value system for education as framed by the federal government of the day, there are explicit expectations that schools articulate their core values in their mission and ethos statements. There is an explicit statement that students should develop responsibility in local, national, and global contexts and building students' social skills and resilience, and that the incorporation of values should play a part in all school policies and practices, including teaching programs across the key learning areas. And this document, as I said, is still available on the Federal Curriculum website. It's called the National Framework for Values Education in Australian Schools, and it contains 9 core values that are, according again to the federal government of the day, meant to be these driving Australian principles. I'm going to read through all 9 just quickly and then go through how and why I think these are the most valuable tool for discussing some of the current events that are happening. So according to this document, the 9 values for Australian schooling are care and compassion, defined as care for self and others, doing your best, which means to seek to accomplish something worthy and admirable, to try hard, to pursue excellence, a fair go, to pursue and protect the common good where all people are treated fairly for a just society, and you can make a mental note of that one, we'll be coming back to it later. Freedom, to enjoy all the rights and privileges of Australian citizenship free from unnecessary interference or control and stand up for the rights of others. The next value that the government published for schools was honesty and trustworthiness. Excuse me, I just had to edit out some laughter there. But it says to be honest, sincere, and to seek the truth. integrity, to act in accordance with principles of moral and ethical conduct, to ensure consistency between words and deeds. The seventh value is respect, to treat others with consideration and regard, respect another person's point of view. Number eight, responsibility, to be accountable for one's own actions, resolve differences in constructive, non-violent and peaceful ways, contribute to society and civic life, take care of the environment. And finally, understanding, tolerance and inclusion. Be aware of others and their cultures, accept diversity within a democratic society, being included and including others. So those are the nine values that, again, the Australian government have published and have laid as a foundation for all Australian schools. And whenever you might find students coming to you with one of those controversial questions, with one of those difficult topics that might be highly divisive, and you might be in a community where they are more divisive than others. I've certainly had experiences of working in communities that had a large proportion of people who belonged to a particular religious belief or to a particular social and political paradigm where even the discussion of an idea was considered controversial, let alone the substance of that conversation. But referring to these values, if these are, as they should be according to these policies, an underpinning part of everything going on in a school, then to refer back to them as a platform for discussion, as a way of responding to those difficult questions and those controversial topics that might come up, what they provide is a clear starting point for students to try and understand. And the kind of questions that you might get from students will be highly varied, but framing a question around some of those values, perhaps more than others, will allow students to start to form an understanding for themselves that doesn't end up with the teacher potentially being in a position of pushing a particular idea or agenda or even being accused of such a thing. And I did say before, make a mental note of value number three, because what we're seeing at the moment is a real manifestation of frustration at the absence of that value of a fair go. Obviously, the protests that started in the United States were over a particularly egregious incident of an African-American man in custody dying, and the police officers involved have now been charged with murder. But here in Australia, it is tapping into the ongoing frustrations that communities feel over the deaths of Aboriginal people in police custody. You know, it's been nearly 30 years since we had a Royal Commission into the issue. And as you may have seen from the many protest signs and content on social media, there have still been over 430 deaths in custody since that Royal Commission was held. And it is a tragic highlight on the current situation that just over the last couple of days, there's been another reported death of a man in custody in Western Australia. And as I said before, referring back to these government-devised values for education in Australia, at the very least provides a platform for discussion and inquiry that not only comes from a government source, so hopefully provides teachers with a fair bit of confidence with what they're discussing, but it frames it around those essential concepts of what we value in society or what we aspire to value in society that might help students to make sense of the conflict they see in the world around them and come to some understanding of their relationship to it. And I just want to be clear, this is not even just my opinion. This is not even just me proffering a pie-in-the-sky approach. If you, I work in the New South Wales public education system, and if you go and read their policy on this particular issue, the idea of controversial issues in schools, it refers, apart from its discussion of the need for content to be age-appropriate and relevant to the curriculum, that policy refers to these discussions being centred in the values of public education in New South Wales. It's interesting to note that the New South Wales public education system has a slightly different set of values than the federal government. though that's mainly in their specific wording than necessarily their conception and intent. But even in the New South Wales value system, it talks about fairness, being committed to the principles of social justice and opposing prejudice, dishonesty and injustice. So it's interesting to see a government policy talking about schools needing to actively promote and pursue social justice at a time when there is a lot of criticism of governments of all tiers for potentially suppressing or interfering in people's pursuit of social justice through large-scale protests. But wherever you teach, whatever age group you teach, 2020 is a year in which the world has been locked indoors and then in some parts of the world burst out of those doors screaming. And we just cannot expect that young people looking to the world around them won't have a sense, of nothing else, than of there being something very wrong with the current situation. And teachers in any classroom may well find themselves called upon unexpectedly to either respond to questions or potentially even to intervene in a disagreement between students who have formed differing opinions and viewpoints on conflicting and controversial issues. So wherever you are in Australia, I strongly recommend that if you've never seen it before, you do a search just for values education in the Australian curriculum, and it will take you to many of the key resources. I'll put a link to the booklet I've been referring to in the show notes for this episode. But over the years that I have been engaging with this values content as an underpinning element of curriculum, I can honestly say it has never failed me as a basis for a meaningful discussion with students about controversial issues. And whether it's the current situation with people protesting against systemic injustice towards different groups within society, whether it was during the time of the same-sex marriage campaign, whether it was even going back to teaching during the time of the national apology, and some of the conflicting attitudes that came out of students regarding Australia's history with our population of First Nations people, the notion of values underpinning why we do what we do is something that is an incredibly useful platform to start those discussions from. Though, again, I do remind you of my earlier warning, please make sure you're aware of the particular policies of your system and school before you engage in any such conversations, because despite the existence of a PDF on a website, schools may still have very different expectations, very different policies, and even communities may have very different expectations of their schools, especially those communities that have a lot more direct say over the governance of schools than might happen in a wider education system. But wherever you are, and however this may be manifesting among the student population of your school, please also remember that there's still a global pandemic going on, and to keep washing your hands so that we don't have too many more school closures or outbreaks before we have to deal with the next thing that 2020 throws at us. I'm going to take a short break now, and when I return, it will be with this episode's main feature, a feature edition of Kolber's Corner, with an interview about professional coaching for teachers with Chris Munro.
The Teachers Education Review is produced by teachers for teachers, exploring ideas to help improve teaching practices around Australia and around the world. If you like the TER podcast, you can help us to promote and improve the show. If you have an idea for a feature segment, a strategy you'd like to share as part of the Teachers Brains Trust, or if you would like to leave comments or feedback on one of our episodes, then please visit our website at terpodcast.com, where you will find information on ways to contribute to the show. To help promote the show, leave us a rating and a review through iTunes, Stitcher Radio, SoundCloud, or whichever portal you use to subscribe to the show. Share your favourite episodes with colleagues, other educators that you know, or with anyone who has an interest in learning more about education. Finally, if you are organising an educational event and would like it to be considered for a feature on the Teachers Education Review, then contact us via email at info@terpodcast.com. Thank you for supporting the Teachers Education Review. Now please enjoy this episode's main feature.
regular listeners will be familiar with our new segment, Kolber's Corner, hosted by Stephen Kolber, in which he's been sharing both some of his experiences supporting teachers in Cambodia, as well as his advice for technical tips on instructional video. Well, in this feature edition of Kolber's Corner, Stephen Kolber catches up with Chris Munro, the Australian Managing Director of Growth Coaching International. We last spoke with Chris a few years ago when he was really first stepping out into the world of educational coaching. And in this interview, Stephen talks to him about his journey and experiences along the way and how he sees the value of effective coaching as a professional learning exercise for teachers in schools. So here now is our feature edition of Kolber's Corner.
I'm with Chris Munro. We're discussing the article, Why Teacher Autonomy is Central to Coaching Success and Coaching a Bit More Broadly. Just as a forewarning, Chris, I'm trying to go a little bit broader than coaching or be very specific because I feel like coaching as well as teaching is something that it's very easy to talk about in the abstract without examples. So how do you introduce yourself to people who aren't familiar with the type of work that you do, firstly?
Oh, thank you, Stephen. How do I introduce myself? First and foremost, I usually say I'm still an educator. I'd like to say I'm still a teacher, but some people would strongly disagree with that. Somebody in a program once said to me very kindly, "You're still allowed to call yourself a teacher, Chris, because that's still your professional qualification." And I thank them profusely for that because I still identify as such a part of my identity. So I'm an educator, but now I work with other educators to help them improve the quality of the conversations they have with each other, and the way we do that is through coaching and coaching approaches. So, working with school leaders, working with teachers, doing coaching training, but also still doing coaching for school leaders as well. But all of my work is in education, predominantly in school settings, but increasingly the broader definition of education contexts. Yeah.
Right, and so the last time you were on the TER podcast was in 2016, and your last kind of part of the podcast was you saying that you're off to try this coaching business. Yeah. So, you know, almost 4 years on now, how's that gone? Where are you at now?
That's amazing that's so long ago. Yeah, I was stepping out of school for the second time in my career. I stepped out into university for 5 years before I came to Australia and then came back into schools here. And that was stepping out again out of not comfort in a cushy way, but the familiar, you know, and the annual leave reduction and all those kind of things. But listen, I frequently say, Stephen, I've got my dream job. I get to do what I love doing. I get to immerse myself in an area that's become a specialism that I'm really passionate about. And I get to do that for a living. That pays the mortgage. So without being seen as going to the dark side of consultancy, as you and I joked about earlier, I still feel as I'm in and amongst schools and educators and amongst my people still, whereas there's a lot of vendors out there selling shiny things to schools. I'm quite fiercely defensive that's not what we do at GCI, and I'm now lucky enough to work with people closely that were academic heroes back then when I was doing it in school. Then people at Gym Night, you know, who I now get to converse with regularly and would call a friend and a colleague. So it has that trajectory has panned out really nicely. Obviously, we're in challenging times right now, the same as you are in schools. But I still feel as though I'm in and amongst schools and school leaders and making a difference just from a different angle.
Right. So in the Edu Reading group that we run, we often speak about Edu Gurus. Do you want to just share your 10 cents on, obviously you're in that world, you're in that kind of space. Would you consider yourself an Edu Guru? Is that a dirty word in your industry? How does it sort of...
Do you know, I still, and as the teacher bit in me, I still bristle at even the words like in your industry. Like I'm sad, or products, or
as I said,
but you're right though. I have to be quite open with this, that what I do for a living now in coaching, and all my colleagues and consultants and so on, It's what the job is now. It puts food on the table. But your first question, yeah, I do bristle and I did cringe at the edu guru thing. I think I certainly wouldn't put myself there, but certainly some would say, you know, Christian Van Nieuwburg, Professor Christian Van Nieuwburg is my boss. He's the executive director of the company. He's also still an academic. There's a nice bridging way that we're operating as an organisation, that we've got a foot in practice still through the work we do in schools. We've got people who are still academics, still doing writing and research. I get to dabble in both of those and we do the training. So I'd like to think we were unique in that sense. But I think both Christian and Jim, Dr. Jim Knight, and John Campbell, our founding director, people would see them as world thought leaders. Professor Rachel Lofthouse, who's in partnership with us at the University of Leeds Beckett, they're world thought leaders in the field. But I know each one of them would balk at the term eduguru, and they don't want to be introduced at conferences as the guru or the expert. They know a bit more, they've done some of the research, and that's the way they would position themselves. And I think that's something we need to hold on to, because it's part of what we would call a coaching way of being. One of the main characteristics you need to be an effective coach or even an effective professional developer is humility. And when you meet these people, the humility shines through. Even though you know they've got the books, I've got a pile of them sitting here behind me, you know, that doesn't come across in how they interact. So I want to hold on to that and try and stay grounded. And I think as soon as we don't, we run the risk of being one of those edu gurus who's then wheeled out for the keynotes, and good luck to them. I won't name names, and you won't name names, but I don't see us in that space. But listen, we bring a lot of expertise to this and a lot of wisdom, but it's how it's conveyed, I think, and how it's shared through partnership with education communities that's important.
Yeah, for sure. All right, so let's kick it off with the first one. First question we've got here. So my impression is that maybe in an ideal world that coaching would be sort of the primary means of professional learning, or some sort of human and relational aspect would be the core part of it. But as we know, to lead on from our EduGuru discussion, I guess it's a lot of it is sort of large educational conferences, and it's most things are done at scale rather than in a personal one-to-one relationship. Is that how you see it? Like, do you think a more developed or a more mature educational system might be more open or more active around coaching?
There's two things there. The word maturity is an interesting word. I think it's maybe maturity might be in that sense acknowledging the complexity of the work, and genuinely acknowledging the complexity of the work. And then the complexity of the work means that we need a broader range of professional learning options or avenues for professional educators, whereas a less mature or more simplistic view is basically one size fits all PD. They don't know what they don't know, we'll just spray it at them and tell them. The Americans call those kind of PDs, you know, sit and get PD, or spray and pray is my favourite. You know, just spray stuff at them and hope some of it sticks. And you and I don't know how long you've been teaching, but certainly anybody who's been teaching any length of time has been subjected to quite a lot of that kind of PD. And the hope is that some of it will stick, and you might sit there and be really enthused, really engaged. You might be listening to one of your edu gurus on the stage and you think, this is fantastic and I'm really inspired, yet you go way back to school with your show bag, and I've still got some sitting on the shelf here behind me. You don't find them again until you move office and you go, I remember that conference, that was great. But did you actually do anything with it? Did you change anything in those deeply ingrained habits and practices? Probably not, more often than not. And actually, Michael Fuller and Andy Hargreaves, others have been saying this for decades, that traditional PD is problematic and it's a huge waste of money at worst. So I think, maturity for me, the word maturity would mean a more sophisticated, nuanced understanding of how adults learn. I think we're in danger of treating teachers like students and or empty vessels. And the highly directive top-down approach to PD doesn't work for a whole number of reasons. It's not very effective in getting the message across. It's efficient on scale from a numbers point of view, but in terms of individual contextual implementation of the new learning, assuming there was new learning, requires one-to-one support. And there is solid scientific research around that. The ones that are most cited is Joyce and Showers, Showers and Joyce studies in coaching, where it was about implementing particular strategies that had been taught traditional PD. And they found that when you partnered with another knowledgeable adult, and it looked very like coaching early on, the degree of implementation and sustained implementation rocketed, because you had that one-on-one contextual support in there right next to the action. The challenge with traditional PD is it's separated from the action. We can't create praxis through that, that link between your actual real-life context and the new learning that you're doing. So we're often guilty in education of detaching the two. And you've got to sit there in a workshop, or you've got to sit there in a conference and imagine what this would look like in your world, in your class, not just your school, in your classes, in any given day of the week. And all those factors just don't play into it. So you need support, and we know that coaching is an effective way of doing that. There are others, highly effective professional learning communities, a degree of mentoring. You know, we're not saying one's good, one's not good, but those kind of more personal supports, localised supports, are often what makes the difference in terms of implementing something that might have been a good intention when you left that PD that never quite materialises in action and sustained action. So I think, I'm not sure if that answers your question or what you mean by maturity, but I think the mature view at all sorts of levels, from politicians, policymakers, school leaders, right down to teachers and how they think about professional learning. Maybe if that was more joined up and sophisticated, maybe maturity would be a word I could go for. Yeah, it challenged me, yeah.
Thank you. I was just this morning I was speaking to someone that participates in the group, Dr. Paul Heary from the UK, and he was basically saying that coaching doesn't happen in the UK, and he's a principal or a head teacher, as they call them over there. And if it was happening, he would have known about it. And at least my impression is that they're more focused on their research and their CPD and their kind of research ed kind of personal internal development processes, maybe. Yeah. Whereas we're a little bit more open to coaching in Australia would be my broad sweeping statement. I don't know if that fits with your
I think you're probably right. And people like Christian Van Nieuwburg would tell you that because he's based in the UK. Rachel Lofthouse will tell you that as well. So one of the people I would direct you to there, coaching is happening in the UK and has been for a long time, but it's probably not getting the profile that it's had here or in America. Certainly instructional coaching is not a big thing in the UK yet. But the reference there would be Professor Rachel Lofthouse, and that's at Leeds Beckett University. She runs the Collective Ed group, so it's a bit worthwhile you guys connecting there as well. And Collective Ed is the mentoring, coaching and professional learning hub at Leeds Beckett University. And they have open access papers and think pieces and things that they publish. But that would be a good way of getting a handle on what is happening in coaching and mentoring in the UK. It's really flourishing just now. So it is, but I think Australia is at the leading edge of this. America has more evolved around instructional coaching in different ways on scale, but certainly a lot of the innovative work and different applications of coaching is happening in Australia just now. I think that'd be a fair broad statement for you to make. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, that's all. I start with a broad statement, and you take it from there. All right. So the next one's a bit of a challenge, I think. In a world enamored with impact, how would you counter the perception of coaching being a low yield intervention? And so by that, obviously, we're thinking sort of big picture data. We're looking for students to jump up certain quartiles and so forth.
Yeah.
Whereas coaching is by definition, one-to-one.
Yeah, so low yield again, yeah. And the word impact, I agree. There is a world enamoured with impact and the what works agenda and, which can become very reductionist, prescriptive. I have all those anxieties. My view here is coming very much from a teacher autonomy point of view, but we can say more about that later. Autonomy doesn't mean a free-for-all. Doesn't mean teachers pick their own adventure. We all work as part of a system. We can challenge, we can nudge, we should have a voice in that system. But there will be constraints around teachers' work. And there is a lot of research and an increasing amount of research around what might be more well-founded, productive strategies than others. I'm kind of echoing Dylan Williams' take on it there, rather than it tells us what works and you should all just do this. I don't subscribe to that. But that notion of impact, that then when you implement these strategies or you operate in a particular way in a school or you offer coaching or mentoring or any other kind of intervention, or you do your big PD, which there's still a need for, to sow new ideas, to challenge people, to push thinking. Can you make a causal link from that right through to student outcomes? I think that's the holy grail that politicians and others would love to see. But I think anyone who is properly tuned into the complexities of the work of educators knows that that's probably an unattainable target. I think what you can do, and we are seeing studies emerging that show sustained influence on teacher practice. Mm-hmm. Teacher practices, and the word sustained is important there as well. There was a meta-analysis done by Matthew Kraft and David Blazar. I don't have the actual citation here at my fingertips, but a couple of years ago now, I think, where they looked at, and it was based in America, they looked at a whole range of studies of coaching, and it was instructional coaching, so it was around particular high-impact practices or high-yield strategies or well-founded, whatever language you want to use this week for them, but those things that are perceived to work more often than not. I hope I've been tentative enough with that. And they did find links through, a through line through to student outcomes. But it wasn't completely convincing. There's more work to be done. But they also highlighted some of the issues of coaching at scale. And some of those I recognise are around the quality of the coaching, of the coaches, the access to the coaching, because it's a resource-intensive thing compared to your one-size-fits-all PD. But so in terms of yield, it depends what you're measuring, and it depends on who you're asking. But I think I don't think that discounts it as a strategy. I think it's becoming much, much clearer what happens when you do that top-down, you'll all just teach this way, and you treat teachers like trained monkeys, and all of the theory around motivation will tell you that that doesn't work, and not that it doesn't work, it makes things worse. So it links to things like teacher retention and so on. There's actually a whole load of other benefits to respecting teachers and supporting them one-on-one, but still against a backdrop of, yes, we do know a thing or two, even though the work is complex. That doesn't mean, that's not a defence to say, well, who's to tell us what works? Well, we do know some things are more well-founded than others. Is that a suitably soft way, without it being so soft that it means nothing? But what are those practices that we know in that setting, at that time, in that study, seem to have a higher degree of effectiveness than the not? And I think that's the discussion you're stimulating through your edu reading group, which is great. You know, that, and the more of that, the better. Because it all sits against that. How do teachers engage with research? Is it written for them or not written for them? I think that kind of bridging thing that you're doing here is really, really valuable in that. But then who curates that? Who chooses, you know, what counts and what doesn't count? So there's a whole... But I think if we're trying to trace coaching, those teachers were coached and therefore those students led. There's an emerging body there, but it's just as hard as is tracking the impact of any other professional learning intervention, because you can't eliminate all the other things that are happening in the school at the same time. It's really hard to do control trials on that kind of intervention. So there is some out there, but it's still, I get it can be challenged on those impact grounds or what works grounds. But philosophically, that might depend on which kind of camp you subscribe more to, as to how willing you are to be flexible and go with it and see what happens. Yeah. Mm. Don't know if that answers your question, Stephen. You've got me rambling again.
It does. The context is kind of my wife and I are involved in an organization that develops teachers in Cambodia. Okay. And so for 13 years we've been, as an organization, that's been happening. Yes. And it's only kind of quite recently that, you know, we contact other organizations and they sort of say, how do you evaluate impact? And I think the core two things are, sort of professional learning is such a black box of, we're not exactly sure if professional learning, as you said, is the holy grail, a through line to student impact. And then also teacher quality. So, you know, if you coached me, it would be a better example than me coaching you for sure. And then my view of the world changed, and then my practices changed as a result. Right. It might be like, you know, a 3-year lead time, but in 3 years I might have a much worse class or a much easier class or vice versa. And there's so many other factors.
I think that's right. I think when, and there's an attraction for school leaders who are under pressure from the next level or whatever system it is above. And this is one of the commonalities we see right around the world, that they're responding to a form around them, and they're trying to create that form around the work of their teachers in schools. And increasingly, the more controlling that is, the less autonomy teachers perceive themselves to have. But if I asked you, you know, if I could give you your dream professional learning situation that developed the kind of teachers you want in your school, depending on who you spoke to, you might get a different answer, because the politicians might say, or certain senior leaders might say, the kind of teachers I want are ones who get the top scores and the top this or that, and they'll measure it in different metrics. If you said to me, I want teachers who feel like thinking professionals, who feel hopeful for their future and the future of their kids, that might all sound nice and warm and fuzzy. Politicians won't like those kind of measurements. But I'll tell you now, that's a couple of the key outcomes from me of meeting a teacher where they're at. I think one of the figures you would see coming through there is teacher retention increasing. People feeling more autonomy, more professional trust, more of a degree of influence on their work. For me, that's the kind of professionals and profession that I would want to be part of. That then we do need to make a leap of faith to say that's likely to result in better outcomes for the students, you know, and sometimes the wrong thing is driving this, and it's the measurement of the metrics and the results and the attainment and the published data and so on. And I think there's also some things, sometimes it happens with teacher standards and so on, that things that were actually intended to professionalise the profession, the way they are then administered or implemented, ends up inadvertently deprofessionalising or making teachers feel deprofessionalised. And I feel really strongly about that, that that's a place where coaching, even within that context, without me being an activist and having to challenge and fight the fight, which is all good, I still feel that in my class, where it's me and my kids, I have enough degrees of freedom and degrees of influence, and I can see the change and the enhancement in their learning and opportunities, that I still feel like a worthwhile professional. I think coaching has the power to do that. But capturing the measurement of that is not always going to satisfy leaders, you know, that accountability for the cost of the intervention. But I think that's the power of it. We can see it at quite a high level. We can see it at a superficial level that teachers are enacting new things. But fundamentally, they're going to hang around and they're going to have their skin in the game longer if they really feel like they're making a difference. And that's what we all want as human beings. So I think there's a deeper philosophical standpoint we need to come from here when we look at these as interventions. You know, I even bristle at that word because an intervention is like a treatment to fix things. You know, so we've got these broken teachers and coaching will fix them. Well, it'll die a death within a year if that's what comes through as the rationale for it. We know that from experience. Sorry, you've got me off again. My soapbox.
Well, I'm just thinking, continuing on from there. So autonomy... one of the key ideas from the article we're broadly discussing is sort of that autonomy is something that's required, and I guess that's the question about maturity as well, is sort of saying a mature system allows autonomy in its teachers, and whether autonomy is a prerequisite for coaching or not, or whether it just makes it easier. I mean, if we just use the UK as an easy example, so I'm a teacher there and I've got Ofsted coming in and sort of with a clipboard, relatively speaking, they're ticking and crossing.
Yep.
I would imagine that coaching would still work there. It just might have some, I don't know, almost bad PR to get through, in the sense that if you came as a coach without the clipboard and you were observing my practice, the kind of the system would maybe give me the wrong impression that you were there for an ulterior motive, perhaps.
Yeah. The Ofsted regime in England, and I, as a Scot, as a proud Scot, I'll correct you there. Ofsted doesn't exist across the UK. It only exists in England.
No.
That's all right. Okay. Yeah, that's okay. Right. That's good, just my bugbear. That's okay. It's not none taken. But yeah, it's probably the worst manifestation of top-down compliance-driven trying to give the public confidence in these perceived hopeless educators out there. And we know it's far from that. And you know all the press around what happens in schools, and some play the system and get teachers to jump through the hoops the day the inspectors arrive, and lo and behold, they get the outstanding grade and so on. But literally, that's about as high stakes as you could get in terms of measurement and judgment and so on, because your school role can literally yo-yo according to what you get. You know, people vote with their feet. So to say coaching could still work there, I think you highlight a really important tension there. I don't think you can be appraiser, and that is really is appraisal, judger, and it's really high stakes judgment that happens in Ofsted. I don't think you can do that and say, and by the way, I'm going to be a coach as well. We need to really clearly separate out those functions. If you took that down to even a school here where you have a review and appraisal system, if you have that, or a performance and development system where technically in the Department of Education your next pay grade depends on it, but we never enact that, quite rightly. But if you don't delineate those, there is an unhelpful tension that does get in the way. You know, if I'm your boss and you know that I can hire and fire you, or I can cap your pay and not let you go up the increment next year or stop you getting that promotion, you're going to tell me what I want to hear. It doesn't matter if I say, now, Stephen, I'm taking my leader hat off. I want you to see me as your coach for this next half an hour. You're going to go, yeah, but how candid am I really going to be? Now, I've seen it work where the relationships are really strong and the trust is really high, and there's a lot of cultural things around that in the school. But it can really get in the way. So the measurement, appraisal, judgment, public accountability, I'd rather keep them separate, and I'd rather position coaching, mentoring, professional learning communities, any other professional learning service that you want to provide in your school to your staff, as just that. It's a professional learning opportunity, and its aim is professional growth. And its aim is to build your sense of autonomy. That doesn't mean you can do what you like. It means that you feel you have a sufficient degree of control over your work to feel as though you're making a difference. So you get those things about feeling like you're competent and getting mastery and getting better at doing what you're doing, which is motivating. You feel as though you've got enough degrees of freedom and enough choice to be able to feel like a thinking professional, not just a trained monkey who's teaching to a script. And that doesn't include, Jim mentions it in his article, it doesn't include the degree of choice where you can say, look, I'm not a morning person, I'll just come in at 10 o'clock. Yep. That's ridiculous. But so it presumes a level of professionalism, and it presumes that things like compliance, mandatory reporting, all those other necessary things in schools, public accountability measures, it presumes that they're all there and in place. So autonomy can be a risky word sometimes, that it sounds like a free-for-all and teachers just pick their own adventure. I think it's helping teachers see the degrees of choice and have as many degrees of choice and freedom as is possible within the system that they work. But I think those extreme top-end, top-heavy things like Ofsted and so on, they completely undermine that, you know, that you're always going to have that suspicion of wariness. I could coach you in terms of how to jump through the hoops for Ofsted, but I don't think it's going to make you feel like a more worthwhile professional. I think it's just going to help you get through that hurdle that's coming up next week that you'd rather not have to do. I could help you cope with it. But I don't really think that's really how we want to be spending that resource in a skill, is jumping through performance hoops. I think it's the wrong measurement, it's the wrong metric again. I hope someday we see the end of that kind of regime, but yeah, that's hopefully been really clear that we need to really separate those as interventions. But some in power, John Andrews and I, friend John Andrews in Queensland, we wrote a chapter in the Flip the System Australia book year before maybe now, on coaching for agency. And that's one of the things we said there, that one of the cautions is coaching should be used for the powers of good, not the powers of evil. In the wrong hands, it could be used to manipulate people and to drive an agenda. I think it won't last very long because teachers will see through it. We're very perceptive. But it could be used and implemented that way. And you'll get people coming to your school saying, oh no, you do coaching here. I've had that. And I'll say, hang on a minute. It's a good thing. Oh, not where I was. We had coaching and it turned into this and it became that. We were told it'd be confidential and then it wasn't. So how it's led and how it's initiated and the clarity of intent and the degree of autonomy and what we mean by words like autonomy and agency and so on, and then walking the talk, I think those are all really important factors here. It's not just we're going to do coaching now and we're all going to coach, or here you've got this service. I think all that messaging around it and seeing it through in your school context is what makes it work and stick around, or just become another fad. Oh yeah, we did that. I remember doing that PD. Remember we all had to do those funny conversations for a few months and then it all fell away. You've seen so many, I'm sure the same as me, so many things like that over the years. My worry is that, I don't think it is, I think coaching's hanging around long enough now that those who get it and see what it is. Where it doesn't hang around, it's because it's been seen as a fad and it's been conveyed that way. And there hasn't been enough depth of understanding or resourcing to make it stick around. Again, I'm straying off topic here again, Stephen. You're just nodding politely as I ramble here.
I'm just trying to pick up the thread. So let's go to, so you mentioned your piece in Flip the System Australia. Yeah. That's something that's relatively overtly activist, I guess, by nature, the compared series. To your average edgy book. Yeah. So I guess, and I mean, you mentioned agency before rather than autonomy. So you prefer the phrase agency than autonomy. But I feel like... is often in our political landscape and such as it is, that teachers are required to be activists. I mean, I know the language you're using is more around navigating and sort of facilitating and working within the structures. Yeah. How would you see the role for activism, which is sort of more flip the system activism. Approach, which is step one, understand the structure, step two, attack, challenge, something like that. Well, I don't know.
You're taking me back. How would you say that? Activism was a very trendy thing. I've got a book somewhere there. I can't. Judith Sachs was the an Australian author. I remember when I was at Aberdeen Uni, one of the texts was The Activist Profession, I think it's called. I can correct that later. I've got it there somewhere. Mm. It was actually one of the course texts for our teacher training program. I remember one of the lecturers that I worked with talked about creative subversion. It was a lovely term. Teachers should be, and we shouldn't be recruiting teachers in their own image. We should be looking for people who've got a bit of that tendency to shake up the system. I'm quite sure that will horrify the politicians in most Western governments right now, which I don't think is a bad thing. But I think the whole rationale of the Flip kind of movement, it was such a privilege to be part of that, was to elevate those voices to say, look, this is a very capable thinking profession. I think, I'm not sure where I am on it, Stephen. I'm not anti it in any way, shape or form, but I think if we have a profession of activists who all have, and we see it on Twitter, we see it with the traditionalists and the neo-traditionalists and the neoliberal and the really toxic, I wouldn't even say debate and discussion. It's just outright argument and it's horrible some of what happens there. But that's what happens when each of them, I'm sure, would describe themselves as activists. So I'm not saying that needs to be controlled by the system or control, but how do we elevate teacher voices? How do we elevate respectful dialogue around what's actually happening on the ground and how things have been played out? How do we build trust in the profession? And I don't mean perceived trust and public accountability, like standards and things are supposed to do, and Ofsted's supposed to do. I think there is, because there's a danger that if we don't encourage that voice, which you might call activism, that we just keep recruiting in our own image and we just keep being this self-perpetuating thing. There's extremes of that, aren't there? There are movements around and there are people who might be seen as edu-gurus pushing in one agenda or the other. But I think there is a... I get the impression, certainly I started teaching in 92 and I don't see much difference around the world, to be honest, in terms of the agenda, the political movements. None of the Western governments are covering themselves in glory right now in education or otherwise. So the commonalities for me are teachers working with teachers, leaders trying to lead a bunch of adults, teachers standing in front of a bunch of kids or sitting in front of a bunch of kids trying to get the best out of them. Those fundamentals don't change the world over, but what does change is the shape of the politics and the system and the requirements and the accountability measures around them. And I think if activism means that teachers have more of a voice in shaping that politically, then that can only be a good thing. If activism means I can grind my own axe to my own ends for my own hobby horse, then I think that can be really disruptive in an unhelpful way. I think the common ground is what we need to be trying to find in terms of what we're striving for. Look, I'm not an expert in that area, and but that's my own personal view in terms of I'd like to see more common ground being found in terms of what we do agree on than those kind of divisive conversations that actually don't make the profession look good anyway. And again, I'm talking to you here as though I'm still a teacher, aren't I? I still feel invested in it, you know, not just as a parent or anything else. I still feel really invested in that there's so much intellectual capacity out there in the profession that we're not tapping into, and we end up deprofessionalising with some of these measures. I think that's the short of it. But yeah, I'm all for activism, but I suppose the cautious bit in me is how and what would the constraints be around the limits of that activism? You know, because you do need a system of some sort, some kind of framework or guiding principles. And I'm sure academics have been trying to establish those for many, many, many decades or, you know.
It sounds like, though you agree in principle with activism having a role, that kind of all, I mean, you've said the word humility a lot of times, so it sounds like part of your core impression of coaching is that it's humilitous?
Humble inquiry. I think you're right, actually, that I should be, my stance needs to be one of humble inquiry, respectful curiosity for you. But if I was coaching you in your school, and let's say I was called the instructional coach, I bring things to the table. Right now, you and I coaching each other as both experienced school leaders. I know a little bit of what your kind of leadership role is in your school. I've been similar kind of head of faculty department kind of roles. So you and I both know stuff about how to run teams, how to do certain things in school. And we sit down and one of us is taking the stance of coach. I still bring things as another adult professional to the table. But if I start delivering that and giving you all my helpful advice and all of my opinions straight off, what I do is I take away your sense of autonomy. I reduce your voice. You feel as though I'm putting myself one up on you, so you're more likely to resist and we won't have a positive relationship. So in being the coach, I've got to really manage my own voice, and I've got to manage when to deploy the stuff that I know that might be useful. Because my experience is from my experience, in my world, in my professional contexts. I can't stand in your shoes. I can't even say I know what it's like to be in your shoes. I think I know what it's like from what you've said, but I can't be sure because that's not possible. So I think coming from a really deep belief in that's the appropriate stance from which to approach a fellow professional educator means that you have to be humble and you have to really self-manage, which is why it's pretty hard work intellectually coaching. Because you're busy trying to tune into them and be really present, but you're self-managing the whole time as well. But if I saw you stuck, I saw you struggling, I saw you about to throw in the towel and you needed help from me and I thought I knew something that might help, it would be very disingenuous of me not to offer it. So I've got to do that in a respectful way that doesn't make you feel like an idiot for not seeing what I saw and put it in very tentative provisional language to you. So it's not that I sit here and it's all warm and fuzzy, just making you feel better. I have stuff that might be useful, but I can't be arrogant enough to assume that I know best because you're the professional in your context. So I think that's the humility thing, and it also links strongly to autonomy, to you feeling a sense of control, influence, choice. Those words all come up. You mentioned the agency. There is a bit I would say there about that, that what that word does is it brings together the other term that often comes up in coaching is around self-efficacy. You can have a really strong sense of self-efficacy. You can believe and know from past experience that you're a really capable leader of a team in a school, for example. But you've just moved to a different environment or you've just had a reshuffle in your leadership structure and all of a sudden some of the things in your contexts have changed and you're not able to act in the same way in that context as you did in your previous. So you can still know you've got it. You still know that you can do it, but you're acting in a different context, a different ecological environment, like a high degree of belief in yourself and proven track record. But you might be inhibited in the degree of agency you can exercise by the context you find yourself in, or the way the school chooses to operate. So I can help you navigate that as a coach. I can help you find a way of working within the constraints that you're finding yourself working in just now and feel more of a sense of autonomy as a result. So I think those terms, autonomy, choice, self-efficacy, agency, they're intertwined and interrelated. But ultimately, I want you to be able to exercise agency. I want you to be able to act in context and keep doing that with and navigate the situation you find yourself in. And if you feel able to do that, you're going to feel more motivated and more worth, and you're going to provide a better service to the kids in your charge, I suppose, ultimately.
Right. So if, and I'm just pulling threads together here, so it sounds like your vision of coaching requires, or maybe at least often features, expertise and humility. So if you were to run a how-to coach 101 workshop, and let's say I turn up and I'm very abrasive and unhumble and inexperienced, overconfident, all of those things, how does the coaching methodology, let's say, if I'm perhaps not the ideal candidate that you would have in mind as a coach?
Yes, yes.
How does your approach respond to that sort of a person?
So there's another couple of tensions there. Yeah. So one is the tension in the coaching between my voice and my knowledge and your autonomy and your voice. So there's a tension there of knowing how and when that I might need to intervene. And if I'm too knowledgeable or think I've got too much, or I'm in too much of a hurry, I might overpower you and you know, take it, you know, not be humble enough or curious enough. But right back to you're kind of asking a question that often comes up in our training workshops. Can anybody be a coach? I'm often asked. Often it's followed with, can anybody be coached? Or is everybody coachable? That's a different question. There's another answer to that one. But can anybody be a coach? I think everybody can follow a process and could have a more structured, managed conversation than you're currently having. You could all do it in quite a mechanistic way. Does it get to really deep coaching where it's that stuff about it's actually changed me as a person and it's really moved me somewhere philosophically and practically in my work as an educator? Probably not. No, I don't think everybody can be. When we talk about the what it takes to coach effectively, we talk about three elements. We talk about the growth framework, but some kind of conversational process that it's a managed conversation. So a good coaching conversation does have a structure. And if I'm leading it, part of my job is to manage the shape of that conversation. And we'll use the growth model to do that. There's other ways of doing it. If equally the coaching cycle has a framework, a structure around it, so it has a formality to it that we both know what we're getting into. There are key coaching skills. So clearly my ability to listen and to ask powerful questions and the kind of questions and the way I clarify that I'm hearing you right, and you know, the way that I build trust, all these kinds of things, what I notice, how present I am, there's fundamental skills that you can learn and practice and get better at. So those first two you can practice, you can work on. But the third important one is way of being, coaching way of being. Jim Knight would describe that. He'd say the parallel in his work is the partnership principles, which really govern how I show up in the conversation. So the way you experience me in the conversation, what it's like on the other side of me, is of a fundamental importance to how successful our coaching endeavour is going to be. And that requires me to have a high level of emotional intelligence, to self-manage, to be self-aware, to be very aware and empathetic to how you are and what's life like for you right now. If I've not got that, and I'm not seeing the need to work on that, then it's very hard to turn that person into an effective coach. So what you need to start there is raising their awareness of what it's like to be on the other side of them. And one of the powerful ways of doing that is 360 evaluation tools, use of video. One of the best ways to become better at this is to watch yourself coach. So you can get better at it, but it is a tougher gig when you get people coming in saying, no, I just need to tell them, surely that's the most efficient way to do it. I know something that's going to be useful. No, no, it's going to be a train wreck if they do that. I just need to tell them. And they need to understand what's actually going on in the human adult-to-adult dynamic at that point, that they're reducing that person's voice, they're taking the ownership from them, and they're actually positioning themselves one up in that person. And they're less likely to get buy-in. They're more likely to get pushback or just passive compliance at that point. And it'll actually erode the trust in the relationship, not enhance it. So I think when you're helping people to become coaches, and I think that word becoming is important, you become a coach, and you become more coach-like in all your interactions, I think that's a sign of somebody who's really got it. Whereas others, it'll be quite superficial, you know, which is a worry when teach schools say, we're all coaches, we've done this one-day training program, now all go off and be coaches. You're not, but you might have slightly more structured conversations if you really stick at it and keep thinking about it. So, yeah, there's a lot of issues under that one, Stephen. But I think, short answer, no, not everybody can be an effective coach. Everybody could probably go right through the motions. And is everybody coachable? You didn't ask that, I raised that. But is everybody coachable? I think everybody has the potential to be coachable. But you're only coachable when you really want to change something. I can't force you to want to change something in your practice. If you come as a customer for change, something you want to do differently or better, a coaching conversation can help you move it to there. But it won't convert you. I can't coach bad behaviour out of you. That's for sure. You know, unless...
Right.
Yeah.
I'm conscious of your time. Yeah. last question. You've got 4 minutes to answer it, no pressure. So the current situation, at least from my perspective, has seen a real devolution in the sort of leadership structure of a school. So you kind of the sort of middle category of your sort of whatever they're called all across Australia, they're called different things, but the people that aren't principals or assistant principals, and they're not full-time teachers either, the people with sort of liminal roles between there. From the research I've done and my experience, a lot of the work that is done by those people is sort of corridor conversations, informal things that look a lot like coaching.
Yeah.
In the current situation with everyone working from their, you know, studies, bedrooms, etc., do you think there's a particular role for coaching or for those types of middle leaders to exert this type of conversation?
Yeah, I think there's more of a need for coaching and the formal coaching and the online equivalent of whatever corridor coaching is. Yeah, it might just be a check-in. Rather than accidentally bumping into somebody in the corridor, you actually deliberately schedule just a quick... We're doing that with our team just now. We're all adjusting to this as well. And just that check-in, if you position coaching or coaching-type conversations, corridor coaching conversations, as helping somebody think something through and move to the next steps... It's as simple as that. And I think now more than ever, there's a need for that solution-focused thinking because it can be so easy in the current situation for all sorts of reasons for us to spiral into problem-focused thinking, and it's really unproductive and it's unhealthy mentally. Someone with a repertoire of solution-focused strategies to help people move beyond the obstacles, but to do that in small, incremental steps when everything seems really overwhelming just now, I can't think of a more pressing time where that those skills are needed. And I'm not really bothered whether you set them up as formal coaching cycles, coaching sessions. There might still be a need for that, and that can be done remotely. But those incidental conversations, I think the thinking needs to move to how do I still create the opportunities for those to happen? And maybe I don't run our weekly staff or team meeting the way we normally would. Maybe we run it as a series of mini coaching opportunities. You know, I think we're going to see this. You're going to see this doing it now this week in Victoria, that school's not going to be the same. And I think the best advice I've heard recently is don't expect it to be the same, that things will change. And I don't mean things, big things. I mean, the way we operate, the way we interact, the way we timetable our day, that applies to everything, including those corridor conversations. So how do you create those opportunities? If those were of value, how can you reinitiate them or generate them? And it will mean we need to stop doing some other things that we did just traditionally. And I think that's a healthy thing. Yeah,
beautiful. All right, on that note, Chris Munro, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Stephen.
I've appreciated hearing your thoughts.
Thank you. Appreciate your time. Cheers. Keep up the good work.
Thank you.
All right, cheers.
And that was Kolber's Corner, featuring Stephen Kolber and Chris Munro. You can find links to both their profiles online in the show notes for this episode at terpodcast.com. That brings us to the end of this episode. Don't forget, coming up soon is the TER Podcast's 7th anniversary episode. And under current circumstances, we are doing an online community event, TER Teach Meet, What We've Learnt So Far. I'm throwing open the doors to any member of the TER audience who'd like to share their reflections, thoughts, and experiences on what they've learned from the last couple of months of remote learning, of adjusting systems and supporting students under stressful circumstances. If you've got an experience, an idea, a reflection, a lesson that you've learned that you believe will go on to have a positive effect on your teaching practice from here on in, please share it with our audience as part of TER Teach Meet, What We've Learnt So Far. You can find more information and links to register in the show notes for this episode at terpodcast.com. We've already had a number of really interesting topics proposed, and I'm looking forward to seeing what more of you have to share coming out of the last couple of months. However, that's all for this episode, and until next time, this has been the Teachers Education Review.
Thank you for listening to the Teachers Education Review. All opinions expressed in this episode are those of the individual speakers only and do not represent the views of their employers or any other affiliated organisations. For links, show notes, and information on how you can contribute to the Teachers Education Review, be sure to visit terpodcast.com.
This podcast is part of the Australian Educators Online Network. AEON.net.au